chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The Secret Truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Tonight we have just a wonderful one, a really fine guest, Matthew D. Whitmer, and he's been involved in helping the Branch Davidian. Just recently, last Tuesday, was a memorial service up at their church up there northeast of Waco. But anyway, I'm going to bring him on and let him tell you a little bit about himself.
Hi, George.
Welcome
Thank
to our
so
program, Matthew D. Whitmer.
To be on your show.
I'll tell you what, you know, we've met the last few years, and we've gotten to know each other a little bit better. And we did have time last Tuesday to sit down and talk a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
And then I went into your site, okay?
Yeah, yeah. That's,
and I really found
good,
out who
yeah.
you are. You know what I mean? I really appreciate and admire all the hard work and effort that you've gone in, that you've done. To try to cast the light of truth on this Waco tragedy. How did you first get started in this, in your interest in the Branch Davidian
tragedy? Well, the first time I had a friend named Jonathan Crosby, who is a documentary filmmaker, who resides in San Francisco, California. And at the time, I think this was 1997 or 98, Michael McNulty had produced his first director's cut of Rules of Engagement, the documentary, and he had what was called the Red Jacket VHS
yes.
version, his cut, that was being shopped around, and Jonathan let me borrow a copy of that when I was visiting him, and I watched it, and I just couldn't believe some of the things that I saw, specifically the FLIR footage that was introduced in the second half of the documentary. Yeah, and I watched it several times and was just dumbfounded that I hadn't known about that information at the time, which was, you know, about 5 years prior, when we all, you know, saw the daily press coverage of what was going on outside of Waco. And so my interest began, and I became instantly kind of fascinated with the building and who built the building and what was the building's purpose. So I started to draw pictures of the building from the video footage and from the press coverage photographs that I could locate at the time, and wound up making a wooden model, like a reconstructed miniature model of the complex out at Mount Carmel. And after I was done with it, I contacted author Dick Revis, who of course wrote the book Ashes of Waco that was published in 1995, and he gave me Clive Doyle, survivor Clive Doyle's phone number, and I began talking to Clive and his mother Edna at the time, and they said that, oh yeah, we could certainly use a model out here at Mount Carmel. We have people come out every day and ask where the building was, and they let me know that the prosecution wanted some money for their model that was used in the criminal trial, and the defense also wanted some money, but they didn't have what it took to afford that model. So I installed my wooden model, or I actually had a mutual friend ship it from California out to Mount Carmel and install it in 2000, or maybe it was early 2001. And so it was the model was in the small visitor center, which is now the green house that sits at the front of the property, and it was there for about 6 years. So that model became sort of the catalyst for me learning more about it, because the more survivors I talked to, they would let me know where they were in the building and what parts of the building they were used to or remembered well. So that's how I first became sort of involved, as you might say, with the events at Mount Carmel. I started visiting Clive and his mother in early 2000. Yeah.
Right. The building is what, sort of a hodgepodge, add-on type of structure where they built parts of it over a number of years? Is that right?
The building famous in 1993 was actually constructed. It began to be constructed around 1990, from what I've gathered. And I haven't been able to uncover any blueprints of it. And actually, I've noticed that there were several differences in published versions of the sort of layout. Like David Thibodeau's book, he's a survivor. He has a version published in his book. I think Dick Revis has a version published in his book. There are versions of sort of blueprint layouts, but there are always differences in them, and the scale always sort of was different in them, and they would often say not to scale. And so I began sort of exploring exactly what the layout was. So I just talked to Clive Doyle quite a bit and would ask him questions, and then asked Bonnie Haldeman before she was killed in 2009 what her memories were of the building. And those conversations led to a diagram that was published in Clive Doyle's autobiography in 2011 or 2012 by Roman and Littlefield. He had a memoir published called Journey to Waco. So, that's how I began sort of my interest in the events at Mount Carmel. It began with an interest in the building, which led to the people and led to many, many, many stories and visiting the property and the survivors ever since.
Right. Where is that model today?
In Waco? Clive Doyle, who lived on the property from about 99, I think, is when he moved back out there. He lived on the property until about 2006, and when he left the property, he packed up all the belongings that were in that small little house, the visitor center, and that went into storage. And he had that in storage for a little while, and then I came out to Waco and collected it. Joel Miner obtained it. He was the archivist at Texas State University at San Marcos. That's where it is today. It's donated in the repository there, and the reason that it's there is because Dick Revis donated all of his research materials, including many hours of the negotiation tapes and all of his research that was used for his book, Ashes of Waco. So Joel at Texas State thought it would be a good spot for the model to be donated right next to Dick Revis's research materials.
Well, it's going to make a difference, It gets people talking about it, doesn't it? And it ignites people's interest.
No,
and we just can't let this thing go.
I think it's important that it does get coverage. And I was glad to see on the 20th anniversary back in 2013 that it did get quite a bit of national coverage, the memorial did.
Yeah, you spoke at Baylor. Now, Baylor University that year, before the 19th, didn't they have a symposium there on the university?
Institute for Studies of Religion, Gordon Melton, had an idea for holding a day-long symposium about a year in advance, if not longer, and that was his brainchild. I thought it was really, really an insightful and an informative idea to hold a conference at which scholars and people who were involved in the siege, even the FBI chief negotiator, Gary Nestner, spoke at that day-long symposium. So, yeah, that was in 2013, and I thought it was very thoughtful of Baylor University and the Institute of Studies of Religion, or they go by ISR, to hold that conference. So, I kind of gave the kickoff speech, which was a visual introduction to the property and what
I think that was really what set the mood and set the the mark to equal, because you really explained and laid out a lot of the physicality there, the building and all that, and I thought that was really a good
thing.
You had an excellent slide presentation.
I tried to figure out how I could sort of deduce my involvement and share just a few slides over the course of just 20 minutes to a half hour to share with people how the property has sort of changed over the years and also inform people about what happened in 93. Because as you know, the property's changed a lot in the last 23 years. Memorials have kind of shifted areas for different reasons. The memorial trees that were planted there in 95 are now along the driveway. It's the same trees, but they're along the driveway. Even this year, I think you may have noticed the tree, that long-standing, really big tree right at the front gate finally fell over, so that tree's no longer there anymore. So, and even this year,
I noticed that.
Has sort of withstood the years. The foundation was completely flooded due to all the Texas rain this April. So I couldn't even see the foundation walls this year. It was like a pond.
Right. Now there was a pool, a swimming pool there on the side, and then wasn't there some kind of buried buses in there too?
Off the side of there.
What was that about?
There was at the northern part of the building, they buried a school bus just below the surface of the ground, and it sort of served as a tunnel, kind of kept the dirt back, so that if they wanted to exit to a storm shelter in the event of a storm, they would be able to get underground to a storm shelter room that was sort of dug to the north end of the complex. That's what was flooded this year, was that sort of dug out concrete reinforced room area, and just to the, I think it'd be to the east of that, behind the building was a really large concrete swimming pool that they built once and it wasn't really working, and then they built it again in 1992, and it still remains there to this day. I think that pool is really important because the tanks couldn't approach the building in 1993 because of that pool. So it served as sort of a barrier to getting to that side of the building, at least from the government's standpoint. I don't think they would drive the tank through that through the swimming pool. Still collects rainwater to this day, and Charlie Pace, who manages the property today, is now he's been making efforts to try to use the pool as a sort of a aquaponic garden. If you go to the property today, you can see several tubs that are along the edge of the pool. He's trying to use the pool water and fish in the pool to, I think, channel back to the garden that's back behind it. But, yeah, the pool is the largest concrete foundation that survived from 1993 from the siege outside of the telephone poles that are to the south of the building. They're still there. Yeah.
Right. Are there services being held inside that church today, or what's the status of that?
He's the one who manages it, and he does have, I think he does hold services there every weekend, to my knowledge. We'd have to talk to Survivor Clive and Clive Doyle and Charlie Pace to see how often they are using the facility for services. But, yeah, every time I go every year, it shows no sign of disrepair or anything. He's kept it up, and Charlie actually built a kitchen along the back side of it. I think around in 2010 or 2011, he constructed a kitchen on the back side, the back end of the which would be the east side of the chapel. So I've been back in there. It's really nice.
Right. You also in 2013, didn't you put together a collage of all the victims, those that died there
in
Mount Carmel?
Catherine Wessinger, who's a religious studies professor at Loyola University in New Orleans, who has been involved with researching and writing about the siege and the aftermath at Mount Carmel for years, ever since 1993.
Yes.
She's been one of the foremost experts on studying the events, the the coverage, the footage, the FBI logs, and she's worked with three survivors to publish their autobiographies. That's Sheila Martin, who's the widow of Wayne Martin, and Clive Doyle's autobiography that I mentioned earlier, as well as Catherine Madison. She interviewed Catherine Madison, and her transcripts are placed in the Texas collection at Baylor University, as well as Bonnie Haldeman, which I think was her first published book. Bonnie was David Koresh's mother, Vernon Howell's mother. Catherine Wessinger asked me if I would compile a collage of photographs of everyone who was killed at Mount Carmel, and I did for her presentation at the 20th symposium that Baylor held or hosted, that the Institute for Studies of Religion held. I think it was called the 20 years later, you know, looking at an American tragedy. And so what I did is I took pictures from the or screenshots from the, there was a videotape that the that was made during the siege, in which many of the people inside the building filmed themselves and sort of talked about themselves. I took screenshots from that. I took pictures from the visitor center at Mount Carmel that Clive Doyle managed for several years that families had sent in, and I made a collage of photographs of all the people that I could find images for Kathy's presentation. I also put it on my website. So yeah, that's where that collage sort of originated from.
I couldn't believe how many children were involved
20,
in this
20,
that lost their lives
20,
there. So there's about 82 Branch Davidians that were killed, and there's about 20 something children.
Yeah.
You're saying?
Correct. Yeah.
Under 18. That CS gas that they used in there, and then they mixed it in with a paint thinner to aerosol, made an aerosol. Wasn't that a formula for fire? I mean, wasn't that just an ideal way to begin to torch that place? I mean, mixing paint thinner in, you know. I understand the CS gas is a powder particulate, very fine powder. So you have to suspend it in the air to pump it into an area like that with an air, make an aerosol out of it.
Yeah, that's what,
but I think they used a paint thinner to do that. Wasn't
documentary purports, and I think that's in fact what happened. I think the official report claims that that is not a lethal mixture, but I think again it's it depends on your context. You know, if it's out on a open environment and you're spraying it, it's one thing. But if it's in an inside closed off area with no ventilation and you're continually pumping that chemical in there, let alone any chemical, into a closed off space without ventilation, I think it's creating an environment that's hazardous.
Now when that started burning, was it phosgene gas that it put out, or what it resulted from the fumes of that, you know,
phosgene
mixture there?
Did
it, was it phosgene or what?
Same gas that's used in the gas chambers is what Michael McNulty says. When it burns.
Okay.
Just on its own, but when it's burning.
No, but when it burns, and it started burning, right? Because the complex started on fire, so the gas was burning and converting over to a poisonous gas then, right?
I don't think that can be disputed, because there was lots of that gas in there. They'd emptied voluminous amounts of that gas inside the building on a really, really windy day. So when it did catch on fire, I don't think it would be disputed.
Right. Now, the tank that went in there and what took out a corner of the building, well, was there a controversy or an assertion that there was a flamethrower attachment on the front of that tank, or what?
One of the first documentaries that came out, The Big Lie, I think it was, is it Linda Thompson's documentary, I think asserted that there was a flamethrower. I've never seen any video footage or any evidence to support that assertion. Yeah.
Okay. Because a friend of mine that's worked on those particular tanks says they have that capability.
ATVs have a lot of capability. I have yet to see flames being cast from tanks. I know they were equipped with booms to insert the gas, and they were certainly entering and demolishing entire sections of the building, including the gymnasium, right through the front doors, through the middle of the residential section, on the northwest corner was taken out. Entire sections of the building were entirely demolished by those tanks.
Let me ask you this about the FLIR, the forward-looking infrared plane. Was it about 8,000 or 9,000 feet, I think, above? And it was flying, and it was it revealed some flashes coming from behind in the rear of the compound. Was there any assertion or assumptions made about those possibly being machine guns or what?
Did some research and came out with a documentary called The FLIR Project, where he recreated conditions that were present on that day. He waited until the temperature was the same, in the same range as it was on that day in 1993, and he used the same firearms, the same FLIR footage, and his assertion is that those flashes that appeared on the FLIR footage taken on April 19th of 93 couldn't have been anything but gunfire. John Danforth's reexamination of the event, in which he had several experts look into it, claims that they are not gunfire, that no wrongdoing actually occurred.
Right.
I do think, from what I've seen, I think that they would have to be gunfire. I don't think...
Yeah, there was some explanation. It was a reflection off pools of water back there. Boy, that was a wild one, wasn't it?
I think it's safe.
You remember that one?
not entirely accurate at all. Yeah, I think looking at FLIR footage, you can't dispute the fact that
reflecting
on that. It's heat-based, and I think it's silly to think otherwise.
Well, the steady flashing would say that it is a machine-like type of function. And so you get back to something that's man-made that
Edward
creates
Allard
flashes like that.
Experts,
see what I mean?
Talks about that McNulty's documentary, as well as if you get the DVD version, there's bonus footage where he continues to talk about it. And he's also cited in David Hardy's book, This Is Not an Assault, which I think came out in 2001, published by Ex Libris Press, which is informative reading about the event.
Right. Now, on the initial, when the ATF got there to the complex, was there not an attack by these people on the Branch Davidian compound, or
why
what?
Why don't we have documentation that would really show us what happened? I mean, the ATF, we have footage of the ATF loading up with VHS, and apparently there was coverage being filmed, but yet no one has any footage. I mean, I think you've seen it as well as much of the American public has seen the well-edited version of the agents climbing onto the roof where you hear gunfire, but I think even those clips, we don't know if the gunfire was from earlier in the raid when they were raiding and edited over the part where they were walking up those ladders onto the roof. I can't imagine agents, law enforcement agents, walking fast or climbing fast or slow up on ladders if there was that amount of gunfire. I think that gunfire that you hear in that clip that's featured on a lot of the documentaries of what happened at Mount Carmel was edited in the beginning, and it's just been reused and reused. So I think, the people inside claim that, they did not fire first. ATF,
Well, the Branch Davidians are alleging and saying, and I've talked to them from that Matheson, we met with them 6 months after the event out here in Austin, and we were on top of this deal, see. But anyway, They all said that they were they attacked with a helicopter. They fired from the helicopter and fired for the through the front door.
Yeah,
and
the helicopter
wounded
coming from the rear
Koresh.
Side of the building, which would be sort of the easterly side, and.
Well, now we did a Freedom of Information request to the governor's office at the time, and Ann Richards was our governor at the time, and we got back a copy of a letter that came out of a court in Michigan, and I think there was a trial, and some witness was alleging in that trial that the Branch Davidians had a meth lab in there. Okay. So I'm thinking that she authorized the use of some of these that helicopter or whatever based upon information from that trial indicating there might be a meth lab in there, methamphetamine lab inside the Branch Davidian compound, which I don't think there ever was.
I think it comes back to context. When was a meth lab there? Carol Moore wrote a book called The Davidian Massacre. And I believe in her book, she talks about names of people on the search warrant being accused of using drugs, when, in fact, I think those names were of people that shared the same name but were different people. There could have been illegal activity on that property during the tenure of George Roden when David Koresh and his community was not even on the property. I know that... it's well documented that when they moved back onto the property following the trial between he and George Roden, when they were not found guilty, after they moved back onto the property, they had to clean it up because of a lot of illegal activity and just a general state of disrepair. So while it may be true that there could have been illegal activity on the property, I don't think any illegal activity as far as drugs was going on in 1993, when the raid went down.
Right. Also, David Koresh went into town a lot. The sheriff of the county testified and told people that had the feds wanted him arrested, he could have arrested him at any time.
Yeah, he was very...
Very accessible.
From what I've read and everything I've seen, he was cooperative and very accessible. Correct.
Right. So, I mean, there again, you know, that, I mean, and then we had Bill and Hillary in the White House at the time. And Janet Reno had
just
become Attorney General, I think, also.
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. But there was a question put to her that indicated that she didn't quite understand what CS gas was.
I think Janet Reno, as I've seen in video footage of her, she said that she's very upset that the information provided to her at the time could have been and has later been proven to be inaccurate. I think she was relying on teams of people to inform her accurately, and I think if you change the context of any information of when you're giving it to somebody, you're not giving them full and complete information. I think she was furnished with information that was not altogether accurate.
Right. There have been rumors, and we've got friends that are Secret Service and all of this other stuff, you know. I've lived here in Austin all my life. But there are rumors that some of this was micromanaged from out of the White House.
Oh, yeah.
Have you
heard
such rumors or anything like that?
The National Archives and Records Administration holds, they did a subcommittee hearings on crime, Congress did, in 1995, and the records from those proceedings were sealed by Congress for 50 years. They're in the National Archives collection, but they're effectively sealed, and those are video and audio tapes, and no one can listen to them until, I think it's 2043. And so we won't have access to that. We don't. Yeah, and so will the tapes.
I'll be gone by then.
Yeah, I contacted
Georgie will be no more.
Now, you know, there's 13 regional divisions of the National Archives throughout the United States. You know, they're centered in Washington, but
Okay.
I did ask, hey, are there any plans to digitize or preserve this evidence so when the day comes we do have access to it? Because I know NARA, as well as any archive, has backlogs and backlogs of paper records and records that they don't have the manpower and the staff to get to. And I was informed that, in fact, no, there is no plan to prioritize these tapes or any other tapes to get it to a point where they're going to be digitized, because we're already looking at it's been 23 years since the event. It's been 21 years since the congressional hearings. So I think that information is going to be on those tapes. Is going to be lost.
Right,
And go. I don't mean to cut you off.
Well,
you
know,
the White House was involved. I think Janet Reno has explained that she's requested information from the White House, and I think she's received some information, but a lot of that information's been redacted. Yeah.
Oh, really? Really? Okay. The bodies were stored, were they not, in some kind of refrigeration unit up in Fort Worth area? And all of a sudden, the electricity cuts off. And then all of a sudden, they go in there and there's mush. Those bodies turn to mush. Is that right? Is that correct?
What's that guy? Jason Van Fleet, his second documentary in the McNulty's second documentary, A New Revelation. Yes,
right.
Rita Riddle and several people testify and claim that trailer was allowed to go without power. So it rendered a lot of the evidentiary value of the bodies as useless.
Right. The trial was what? Moved up from the Waco area to San Antonio. Oh, in the Branch Davidians. But Walter Smith followed that trial, did he not? From Waco down there? He held the trial in San Antonio. He presided as judge.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
No, he was. Walter Smith was there in San Antonio. We had people inside that attended. We had one attorney friend of ours was inside.
Oh, wow.
And almost every day. And then at the end of the trial, myself and two of my best friends, we bought a copy of the transcript, and we stored it away all this time, making sure that it didn't disappear. You know what I mean? Yes, it was a printed copy. It only cost us $300.
Thick or something like that, right?
Oh, it's boxes. It's boxes full of stuff. It's several boxes.
Kirk Lyons donated a copy. I believe it's Kirk Lyons to the Texas collection at Baylor University. It's in Carroll Library, and you can can access that. I know Clive Doyle also has a copy. So I'm glad to hear that you have a copy.
Okay. Well, I told Clive that about that, and he didn't seem to think there were already other copies, so ours was just an extra copy that was not probably needed
or
anything, but
it
was there just in case,
Baylor,
you know.
Whether it's Baylor or Clive, I think somebody really should scan those in and have a PDF version and provide access to that online. I think that would be a valuable document that people could have the ability to access worldwide if it was published online.
Right. You being what? You're in library science, what, information technology and science?
Yeah, I went to UCLA for a number of years for a master's program in library and information science, and with a specialty in archives. Correct. Uh-huh.
Oh, okay. So you understand archiving and all that much better than the average person.
Over the course of 2 years, and that's what I was interested in, primarily because of this case. I was interested in the case long before I went to get that degree, but I worked for a number of years in mental health, helping people who had mental impairments, severe and persistent mental impairments in downtown L.A., achieve their goals, and I became acutely aware of the importance of records and record keeping and how that can...
You worked in rehabilitation services at one time?
Years in an inpatient setting.
Really?
Another 4 years in an outpatient setting full-time, and helped document as a caseworker how people were doing for both psychiatrists and the organization that I worked with in order to help reduce recidivism on the streets, people going in and out of jail. And I quickly became aware of how important records are. And
okay.
And how records can be skewed and how records can be misconstrued and how they can help and how they can hurt people. And after really kind of becoming involved in the record-keeping process and that line of work, following my interest in the events at Mount Carmel, I decided it was time to pursue an education in an area that would better inform me to perhaps contribute or help in sort of exposing the survivors' stories and the survivor's side. So, yeah, that's after I graduated, I've been attending the memorials ever since, and been in a position where I've been able to help in that regards. And Kathy Wessinger invited me to contribute to one of her special issues of Nova Religio in 2009. It was devoted to exploring the issues of the fire around Mount Carmel, and that led to being asked to present at the 20th anniversary symposium. So I feel very fortunate that I've even been considered to do that, but in part that's sort of because I've been going back to the property for a long period of time, and I've been very interested in studying the building and sort of gathering stories from the people that live there, because I don't see that work being done on as wide of a scale as the people making documentaries to sort of kind of rehash the official story, so to speak. Yeah.
Right. How many Branch Davidians attended our memorial this last Tuesday?
I was talking to Clive about
that.
That
are still survivors.
One person told me that they only saw 25. We could count at least 35 to 40 on our hands in the car walking away. I'd have to call Clive and confirm.
Right.
There were more. Mm-hmm.
But survivors, Branch Davidian survivors,
Kathy,
what I'm asking.
I don't know if everybody wants to be named, but there were three. Yeah,
I see. Just give me a number. I'm just looking for a number.
There
you
was
know.
Someone who was negotiated out. There was someone who lived in with the group but was not there at the time of the siege. Those are the three that I know of that were present.
Okay.
Tuesday.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Right. Okay. So there were some Branch Davidian survivors
yeah,
that did
passed away.
Participate at the
Maribel
memorial.
Jones
right.
Would always go, except in the last couple of years, she would often be there. She wasn't with us. And same with Catherine Madison, who passed away in 2009. She used to always be there, but she's passed away. Paul Fatta, who's out in California, wasn't able to make it, but. It takes an effort to up and leave where you're at, especially if you're hours away to go and attend that. I understand that people have jobs and financial commitment. I'm in a position where I've been able to make that a priority, but I know that I might not always be in that position, and I can imagine.
Well, Matthew, that's really nice. It's really dedicated. You're really dedicated to try to help the Branch Davidians and trying to out some of this information.
I feel
that's
like
for sure.
It's something that I wouldn't be doing anything else but that. I mean, I really feel that the issue is worth it. The people are worth it, and I just feel that it's very unfair that their side of the story has not received as much attention as the official story or the print media that was created at the time of the siege, which, as you know, is now considered by many to be the truth or records of the truth because now it's research material, those articles.
All I get from people now is that Koresh was an abuser of children. And that's what I get from people that want to just go, you know, they just want to roll over and sort of rationalize what happened. You know what I mean?
The internet has changed so many things. I don't know if you're aware of the West Memphis 3 case that occurred in Arkansas, completely different issue, but three teenagers were convicted and served 18 years in a penitentiary and were later freed on an Alford plea and allowed to walk out. And I saw an interview with one of them, and he said everything changed. Everything changed for his case when a documentary was made showing a different perspective. And I think in large part that's true with what happened at Mount Carmel. I mean, with Michael McNulty's documentary, Waco Rules of Engagement, it really raised a lot of eyebrows and got a lot of people thinking, hey, maybe we don't know the full story. And that inspired other people like Dick Revis to really dig in and start to look at the issue. And ever since, there's been a movement to sort of re-examine and look at and reflect upon what possibly occurred out there and why don't we have certain records? Why don't we have certain evidence about what went on? And I think that's been very helpful. So I wanted to be at least contribute what I could in line with that sort of thinking.
You know, I'm looking at a photograph of you standing up speaking at the 20th anniversary there at Baylor on the 18th of April 2013, and behind you is that pipe organ, okay? You know, and it's really, you know, I mean, it's a chapel, too, that we had that the symposium was held in. Is that not right?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so they worship, they conduct services in there, so that's why they have the organ in there. Now, I recorded that. They wouldn't let me do the video of that. But they let me do an audio recording, and I recorded it on my Zoom recorder, and I play that sometimes every year. You know,
really
I have it on
valuable.
Site
I mean,
here Kathy and there. You know,
Kathy Wessinger spoke, but, Phil Arnold spoke, Gordon Melton was there, Gary Nestner was there, Phil Jenkins, Stuart Wright. Yeah, I spoke. Kenneth,
you were
Starr,
there. You spoke.
An introduction.
Yeah.
Really important.
Well, he's the president of Baylor, University president of
really,
Baylor University.
Really significant event that the university held. I don't think that they've been really sort of told thank you enough. I told them thank you in my opening, but that was really significant, at least I thought, to basically just acknowledge it and say, hey, let's talk about it.
Right. You're not going to find that often, are you? From
is it?
Of course, Baylor is a private university. See, it's not government. Yes, Baylor is Baptist supported. See what I mean? So they can do more of what they want to do, I guess.
The Texas Collection, which
is a
state repository of historical materials, have really made leaps and strides to hold a Branch Davidian collection on the history of the people who have been there since the mid-30s all the way up through the siege, and they really should be commended for the great work they've done and the help they provide. Every year I go there, I've gone there every year since 2008, and they've been nothing but helpful and professional and in holding those records and providing access to records that otherwise wouldn't be available.
Now, you mentioned something last Tuesday about locating some of the graves of some of the Branch Davidians.
Yeah,
they're buried in different places. Is that correct?
They're buried in different places. That is correct. Yeah, there are many of them.
Okay. So, and I thought that's where your strength is, Matthew, is that you go and you document this stuff. You want to know. And we need to know stuff like that. We need to know what really happened like that. You know,
homicide. I mean, there were dozens of people who died unnatural deaths there, who were killed. Oftentimes, many times I see, you know,
people
died there. They didn't die there. They were killed there. And when you have that that many numbers of unnatural deaths and so many children, and I think it's incumbent upon us to take an interest and say, well, what happened to these people? Where did they go? Where are their families? You know, what's going on? And so that's why I began my webpage that really kind of just strived to document what the property looks like every year and to sort of make an effort to try to figure out and contact people that were involved and put some pictures up and say, hey, you know, here's where so-and-so was buried. Here's where this family resides. You know, here's how this person was impacted. And that's what started my website. I think I began my website in 2006, and it's still up today. It's at stormbound.org. You can see a picture of Clive, Survivor Clive, and Sheila on the front page. And if you click on it, it'll take you to the page. And I've been working with a web designer just this last 2 months, and it's getting ready for that page is getting ready for a major overhaul where I'm going to have a lot more pictures from the past memorials and a lot more pictures of the
property.
So I've reached a point where, you know, I sort of operate on a shoestring, but I invested some money, and soon it's going to be a lot more robust, and there's going to be a lot more content on it. So I'm looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah, man, that is nice. Great, so, Matthew, to do that. And now let's get on to something a little lighter here. You're a type walker, tightrope walker? Tell us about that. Sort of, we can sort of end the program on a lighter note here. You know?
Or
a tightrope note.
Of your listeners may know, there was a Philippe Petit, high wire artist in 1974, stretched a tightrope between the two World Trade Center towers at the very top, and he did it illegally. He did it kind of under the cover of night and walked between them several times, and he's been that story.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Sort of given attention in the last decade, bit by bit, slowly. He published a book, To Reach the Clouds, which then in 2008 a documentary was made from it called Man on Wire. That wasn't the first documentary. Philippe's story has received a lot of attention, just not on that, not on a scale that was released that wide. And then just this past year, a movie with Joseph Gordon-Levitt, which was also about the same event, called The Walk, was released. So I had seen, a friend of mine kept telling me to watch Man on Wire in 2008, and when I finally did, I was just blown away. I couldn't believe that I didn't know about it. I was really impressed with it. And when I started looking online for information about how somebody could learn to tightrope walk, I really couldn't find any how-to sites. I could find videos on how to slackline, which is walking on a thin piece of nylon. They call it dynamic webbing, which is stretchy. It's not guy-line like traditional circus cables. I couldn't find information on how to do it, so I just sort of set out on my own to try to figure out how to tension a fiber and later a steel rope and to walk on it. So I just began sort of as a self-taught wire walker and began really low, walking about 20 feet between two trees. It was about a foot off the ground, working my way up to 60 feet. It was 60 feet distance that was about 5 feet off the ground, to then trying to explore and figure out how to make and create a balance pole to go even higher. And so about a year into my exploration into learning how to tightrope walk, it turns out I met Philippe Petit. He was out in L.A. giving a talk at the UCLA's Hammer Museum, and somebody alerted me to this, and these are
really
great talks, and so I
showed
up early to the event thinking, well, maybe Philippe Petit will be looking at the art at the Hammer, and sure enough, he was. I saw him, and I planned my approach. I thought, how am I going to grab his attention? How can I be swift and short and courteous and not rude? And so I saw him, and I walked up to him, and I showed him a 3x5 picture. I showed him a picture of what's called a tiffer hoist. It's the device that's used. It's a grip hoist is what it's called, that is used to tension cable up to 3.5 tons, and it's the same, model that he used in his World Trade Center walk. So I just walked right up to him, and I said, are you Philippe Bettine? He said, yes. And I said, do you know what this is? And he looked at the picture. He actually took it out of my hands, and he said, where did you get this? And I said, I bought it. I bought it, and I've been using it. He says, this is the strongest hoist ever made. Where did you get this? And I said, I read your
really?
Book, and I've been learning to wire walk, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of this. And he said, you've got the strongest hoist ever made. And he said, you should come work with me. Come study with me. He said, a woman in New York has been asking me for a decade or more to teach a class, and I keep saying no, but I finally said yes. He said, you should apply. He goes, but I'm only working with a few people, so apply now. And he gave me information about how to do that. Well, I didn't even sleep that night. I went home and looked at the site, and I spent all night filling out the form.
Golly, yeah.
What he was doing is he was teaching a course at Elizabeth Streb's studio in Brooklyn, New York. She's a very well-known, I don't want to say performance artist, but a person who's been very interested in movement and experimentation, and she has this wonderful space in Brooklyn, and she had allowed Philippe to design different wires so that he could teach a group of students, or at least expose them to the feelings of and how it comes to be that you find yourself on a wire. So I applied, and I was actually accepted. He taught three classes. They were two-day sessions, and he only allowed six people in each session, and I was in the third session, his final session, where I worked with five other people and Philippe, and was able to ask him questions all day long for 2 days. Oh, it was wonderful. He was great. And I asked him everything, and he answered all my questions as far as rigging, which led to more questions. And he was so funny. He just said, "You should be my autobiography guy," because I would say, "Hey, did you take this rigging in your 1982 book by Random House? Did you take this rigging to France?" He said, "Yeah." He goes, "How do you know that?" And I said, "Well, because I looked at the pictures, and the pictures, it looks the same as the one that was over here." And he goes, "Yeah, you have a good memory." And he taught me all kinds of tricks. So then I came back to L.A. and started employing some of his rigging suggestions, and was able to go move my rigging to about 10 or 11 feet high, and I could go 200 feet long, which is the same distance that he was walking between the World Trade Center towers.
And well, you do it for entertainment, don't you? Like for children's events,
well,
stuff like that. Is that
started,
what you do on some of that?
It was always just to learn how to do it, and it was just to figure out how one does this. It was never with an ambition to perform in front of anybody. It was just to figure out if I could do it. I wanted to see, could I walk the same distance he did? Could I rig a wire the same distance he had done? Could I walk it without a balance pole? And I was able to do it. That led to, I did a few performances for, I did one for the Craft and Folk Art Museum on the Wilshire District of L.A. It's a small museum, and it was like for kids, and I showed them how to rig, and I walked for them and performed for them. I performed at the Buckley School, which is a private independent K-12 school for about 800 to 900 people, doing a tightrope walk, and and I perform out by L.A. Valley College in an area that's not really owned by the college. It's sort of a walkway that's along one of the L.A. River offshoots, you know, the concrete sort of aqueducts. There's an area where you can set up a rigging where you're not imposing on, like in a park, you might be getting in the way of somebody using the field for soccer or baseball. This is like an area where you're not obstructing anything, you're not getting in anybody's way, but you can put up relatively high wire and perform. So, I had done that for a number of years and videoed it and created a website, kind of like the events at Waco, to just create an awareness about it and share it with the public.
Right. Well, that's very, very interesting. We've got about 4 minutes to go. that remain. And what would be some of your concluding remarks about Waco and the Branch Davidians, and anything that I didn't cover or I left out or something? What would be your closing comments in the last 3.5 minutes?
Anyone interested in the events at Waco to pick up a book and read it, and don't hesitate to reach out to any one of the survivors and get firsthand information. It will really illuminate and change your perspective about what occurred back in 1993. Not for a minute do I ever regret doing that, and it's changed my life. I can't imagine where I'd be today had I not reached out and called Edna Doyle, and which led me to Clive Doyle and Bonnie Haldeman and Catherine Madison and Paul Fatta when he was released from prison, and all the survivors have been more than accommodating in sharing their stories and very eager to share their perspectives and tell exactly how they feel. And it's been amazing to me to see how forgiving they are and how interested they are in the public's interest in what occurred to them. So I think picking up any one of their stories, whether it's one of the three autobiographies by Catherine Wessinger or David Thibodeau's book, and setting your opinions about the case aside and reading their perspectives, I think that's really, really important.
You know, you seem to indicate there that they're very forgiving. That's the Christian divine,
yeah,
one of the lessons, isn't it?
You know,
forgive.
People will talk to me and they'll say, well, my friend said, oh, I bet you're really against Janet Reno. They told me to ask Matt Whitmer about Janet Reno, and I say, you know, I've asked Clive Doyle how he feels about Janet Reno, and Clive says, you know, how can I fault her? She had the wrong information. She was furnished with information that wasn't necessarily the whole picture. We don't have any animosity towards her. Clive has said, I think that whole event that happened to us was perhaps some sort of a test. We were like a government test. And I think it's, you know, he says he thinks it's the beginning. But all of the survivors are very appreciative that we're even thinking about them years later. And I think that's why it's important that these memorials continue in Waco every year on the Memorial Date. And I look forward to,
Right. Well, I want to thank you. Yeah, I want to thank you for all your hard work. And stormbound.org is your website. You can find a lot of good information there. And I also want to wish you good luck on your typewire exploits, okay? And you're a very nice person to talk to and visit with, and you've got a really nice personality, and you're really trying to make things better for the country and for the Branch Davidians and everybody else.
You do tireless work as well, and I checked out your website after you we talked, and I'm just amazed at how much content you have up there and how much dedication you've had to the case over the years. I mean, it's amazing.
Thank you very much, Matthew D. Whitmer, and we want to thank you very much for the interview.
Absolutely.
And good luck on everything else, and we'll see you next year in Waco, okay?
Good night.
Okay. Good night. Bye-bye.